Good morning, 7:40 here on the Mighty 690, and it is time for another Wednesday chat with the fine folks from K-State Research and Extension. We have Holly Miner joining us now. How are you doing, Holly?
I'm well. How are you?
Doing well, and David Strongs is here with us, so good to see you as well. We're going to get into some more updates here in our second segment, we were here until midnight last night, so it's been kind of a long one, but it's always good. Election night is always a fun one. So what is going on with you, Holly, with all the food safety and everything, K-State Research and Extension? What's the latest thing?
Yeah, so we have some classes coming up that I'd like to invite people to attend if they're interested in food safety. We have a food handlers class that will be November 15th at the Wilson Medical Center. That begins at 1 p.m. You can call me for more information. November 22nd, we have a food safety managers class, which begins at 8 o'clock in the morning. That's an all-day class, and that class will be held at the research station in Parsons. And then kind of a fun event that we haven't had for a couple years, and it's coming back this year, is Holiday Happenings. That will be November 18th at Penn Terrace in Independence. This is a program that has been done in the past. It's usually a fun time. You can come. There'll be some educational sessions. Each one of our family consumer science agents will be presenting a little information session, about 15 to 20 minutes long. It begins at 9:30 in the morning at Penn Terrace in Independence, and then there will be some food served for the noon meal. So that's coming up here on November 18th.
Very good. No, that sounds like it should be a good event. So always fun with that.
Yeah, it's exciting to get to go back to doing some of the things that we did before COVID. And mm-hmm. so we're excited to be able to offer that program again. The FCE ladies are hosting that, and they're excited to be able to get back into doing some of the things that they have done in the past. So, yeah.
Very good. And so, Holly, since you are the health, food safety, and nutrition agent here for the Wildcat District, we are, as we go throughout this segment here, I just wanted to go ahead and let folks know that we're going to be taking some calls. So this is a good opportunity. If you have questions about food safety or preservation, you can give us a call right now at 620-251-6909 or 1-800-252-5443, and Holly can answer your question. So if you're wondering, you've got any sort of a question about some food safety, preservation, anything of that vein, we would love to answer your question, because we have an expert. We've got experts in the room. It's always good with the folks from K-State Research and Extension. So kind of back to what we've done in the past, apparently, in the program. So we're hoping to maybe get a call or two. So 620-251-6909 or 1-800-252-5443. And I guess speaking of preservation and that sort of thing, I mean, home canning has got really popular during COVID, didn't it?
Yes, it has.
But there are a few things you want to watch with that, right?
There are. There are some recommendations that we have that have changed in the last 20 years. So every food that you can from this point forward should be either processed in a water bath canner or in a pressure canner. And that all depends on the acidity level of the food. So we want to take that into consideration. Those low acid foods need to be pressure canned, and the high acid foods can be put in the water bath canner. A couple reminders that if you're canning tomatoes, you need to make sure you're adding lemon juice or vinegar to them. Tomatoes have had the acidity level bred out of them through different varieties as we've progressed, and so we need to make sure the acidity level is high enough that we can those in a water bath canner. And then another thing with tomatoes this time of year, any tomatoes that have been on the vine when the vine has been frozen should not be canned, because the acidity level of those tomatoes will be way too low, and you could run the risk of canning those in a water bath canner, even if you add the tomato, the vinegar or the lemon juice to the tomatoes, the acidity level will be too low and you could end up with a product that is unsafe to eat.
Mm. That is interesting, and I didn't know that. And of course, tomatoes being quite popular, because they're you know, if people don't have a pressure canner, I mean, not, that's something not everyone has. They sell the little kits, though, especially that people kind of marketed for entry level canners, and it can be pretty easy. But yeah, I did not know that about the acidity. That has been changing over the years as we kind of stray away from some of the heirloom varieties, and we have all these different like Celebrity and that sort of thing. All these different varieties that have some really great traits, but they also come with that kind of genetic change.
That's right. You know, we like to eat a tomato that's not quite as acidic when we're eating it, and so those changes do affect how it's canned, and so we want to make sure that we're adding that acid back into it so it's safe after it is canned.
Sure. If you have any questions for Holly Miner, you can give us a call, 620-251-6909 or 1-800-252-5443, any sort of thing. Question about food safety that you might have, or preservation. Food preservation would also be another topic that we can discuss, or really anything relating to these. And the foods that we're preserving right now, I know we are still kind of in apple season. A lot of people like to dehydrate apples. Any particular items with that?
So when we dehydrate, we want to think about the food that we're dehydrating and whether it will brown or not. And so in the case of apples, we might add some fruit fresh to them or some citric acid to them, which is basically vitamin C, to be able to keep them from browning. So you could dip them in lemon juice, you could dip them in apple juice, which will also help, or sprinkle them with fruit fresh, or put fruit fresh or something, citric acid in a water bath, in a water, dissolve it in water and dip them in that before you dehydrate them. So those apples, bananas, peaches, any kind of fruit that's not citrus fruit would probably be things that we would want to make sure that we dipped before we dehydrated to keep them from turning brown.
Sure, that is absolutely a good tip, and that'll help you win the prize at the state fair if you're if you're competing for that. You know, you own all the tricks. But
yeah.
But hey, if you have any questions, this is just a great opportunity. It's always good to have folks from K-State Research and Extension in. So I know we haven't done this for a little while, but hey, if you would like to give us a call, now is a wonderful time to do that. 620-251-6909 or 1-800-252-5443. Holly, any other topics that you want to discuss? Well, first, let's go ahead and go to the phones. You can grab the headphones so you can hear this caller here. So good morning, caller. You are on our program this morning.
Yeah, hey, I've got questions on food safety. Not probably like some people, I end up leaving things in the refrigerator. And I'm just curious, you know, how to know, like for a couple examples, like lunch meat, maybe turkey, it's been in the refrigerator for a couple weeks. Like, can you smell it, look at it? Assuming you can smell. I did lose my smell for a while. And is there a good way to test? And, you know, also like if a burrito got left for maybe a couple weeks in the refrigerator, how do you know?
Okay, that's a great question. And especially with turkey coming up, with Thanksgiving being just around the corner, is something that people really need to think about. So if the food is prepared at home, like if you made a turkey for Thanksgiving dinner, and you wanted to keep some of that in the refrigerator, and you know we always make more than what we can eat at that time, so there's always leftovers. A good rule of thumb, the National Restaurant Association recommends food not be kept more than a week, 7 days. So if you prepared Thanksgiving dinner on Thursday, by the next Wednesday, that food should be either eaten or thrown away. One thing that people don't think about a lot of times with leftovers is that figure out how much you think you're going to eat of those leftovers in the next few days and then freeze the rest of it. And you can always get it out and use it later. So freezing leftovers is a great way to do that. I would not eat anything that has been in the refrigerator for more than a week. lunch meats that are processed that you purchase in the store are a little bit different, because a lot of times the package will say use before and it'll have a date on there. And sometimes those dates are 2 or 3 weeks out. So if it's something that is packaged at the store and processed commercially, then those dates that are on the package, you could go by that. They've been processed with preservatives and things like that to help keep them longer so they don't spoil as quickly as something that we would prepare in our home ourselves. Another thing that we need to think about is when you look at the food, you may be able to look at it. If it's slimy, then obviously we don't want to eat a food that's slimy. If it smells bad, then yes, you probably need to throw it away. There's a good rule of thumb that we go by with when we're talking about food, and that is, if in doubt, throw it out. So, you know, you may think, well, you know, I spent $10 or $15 on this food. I don't really want to throw it away. But what is your time and your health worth if you eat something that you're questioning and you become sick and you're off of work a day or two, or even worse, that you become hospitalized? So, you know, a $5 or $10 piece of leftovers, or that burrito that's been in the refrigerator for 2 weeks, you know, could cost you quite a bit of money if you become ill. So, you know, when in doubt, just throw it out. And if it's green, obviously, you know, you're going to want to throw that away. So, yeah, just use some common sense. And a lot of times I'll put something in the refrigerator. Like, I was looking last night in my refrigerator and I had some leftover pizza, and I'm like, when did I make that pizza? And so I got to thinking about it, and I'm like, okay, I need to eat that today. And I only leave food in my refrigerator about 4 or 5 days. And after that, then I toss it, because I don't like being sick and I don't want to be sick. So my 7 days is a lot shorter than most. Great question.
Yeah, thank you, caller, for calling in. I really do appreciate you asking that question today. Thank you so much. Have a good one. All right. So, yeah, we do appreciate calls in, and we do have just a couple more minutes if you would like to give us a ring here on the program. We are talking with Holly Miner from K-State Research and Extension, and talking food safety and preservation. So an important topic, a good one to remember. And if you have a call, if you would like to have any questions for Holly, 620-251-6909 or 1-800-252-5443. I was just amazed, Holly, at I had a little can of Vienna sausages that I opened up and had a few, and then I put them in the fridge. And then I forgot about them. And it's just amazing that they can sit in that can for so long and, you know, have no issue. And then I opened it up. I was like, oh, man, it was moldy and all gross. And I was like, it's just amazing just that all, we don't realize how much is floating around in the air as far as mold spores and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And once they find something to grow in, I guess they just kind of take off.
Yeah. It doesn't take long for foods to become, you know, unsafe to eat. So.
Yes.
I do have another program that I'd like to talk
yeah,
about
we,
while
let,
we're
let's
waiting.
Let's go ahead and go into that.
So there's a new program, a new training program called the Master Food Volunteer that is available, and we are offering that in the Wildcat District. And so anybody that is interested in food and loves to cook, or they're passionate about nutrition, health, or wellness, and that would love to learn and be able to give back to their community, this is a great program to become trained in. The benefits of that are that we're meeting with others that have like interest and a passion for food. We are participating in classes. You can either lead a class or help teach classes about food preservation or any kind of nutrition topic. You will, in this program, you'll learn up-to-date practices on food safety and nutrition, and then you'll also take any knowledge that you have. You can take that to the next level by getting a little more in-depth into this with this training program. what is required. A master food volunteer goes through 40 hours of training in the course. It's taught by myself and two other extension agents. There's extension specialists and industry professionals that will have talk. After the training, the volunteers will give a minimum of 40 hours of service back to the community, and I'll work with them to be able to develop those programs and get and have them have opportunities to give back to the community. Volunteers will be able to work with youth. They'll be able to work with adults. So if you have a passion in working in one of those areas, we'd love to be able to have you come in and volunteer and work with a group that you're interested in working with. To apply, there's an application form that's on our website. And there's also, if you email me or call me, I can send one of those out to you as well. Applications are due on December 1st, and so that deadline's coming up pretty quick. There is a fee for the program, and I have more information on it available. So if you get a hold of me, I can send out that information and get that to you. My phone number is 620-331-2690. Or you can email me at haminer@ksu.edu. And that training class takes place January 17th through February 25th. It is an online Zoom class, so you can do that on your own time. So if you're working during the day, you can take that class at night. There will be some hands-on sessions that we'll be doing, three of those during the course of the time that the class is offered, and those should be fun experiences where you'll get to meet other people that are in the class in the other two districts that are working on providing this training. So
it really does sound like a great opportunity, and just kind of like people are interested in gardening and can learn and kind of give back with the Master Gardener program. You know, this is just very similar for food, and I think that that's great because there's so many people out there who have a love of food and like to share that and do it safely, of course.
Yes. So we'd love to have you come and join us, and just give me a call at 620-331-2690.
Okay, well, very good. That's going to about do it for this segment. But coming up after the top of the hour and the news, we'll chat more with David and see her updates and everything here on our talk with folks from K-State Research and Extension's Wildcat District. So we'll be back with more here on the Mighty 690 KGGF. Good morning, 810. We are back here on the Mighty 690 with friends from K-State Research and Extension's Wildcat District. We have David Skronks with us now, the Diversified Agriculture and Natural Resources Agent. How are you doing this morning?
Doing good, thank you. How are you?
Doing well. Good to have you in here. On this kind of, it's still kind of overcast out there. I noticed when I got up, it was just it was a little bit kind of cloudy. And last night when we got done with election coverage, I mean, it was the quietest night. It was so quiet. I felt so bad, like, you know, trying to slowly, quietly close my door and not wake the neighbors, because it was silent. But hey, it's a wonderful Wednesday. So what do we have going on in your world? I know we have you have a program coming up you want to talk about.
Yeah, so there is a program coming up on December 15th. This is actually a program put on by the state office. So the K-State Ag Economics Department is hosting this program. It is the Farm and Ranch Transition Conferences. They're actually doing three of these across the state, but the closest one to where we are at is going to be held in Erie on December 15th. It is an all-day program. It starts at 8:30 and goes until 3 in the afternoon, but they will, you know, have coffee, donuts, all those good snacks at registration in the morning, and they will be feeding you lunch, so you'll get a little bit of a break there. And the keynote speaker for this program is Dr. Farrell. He's an associate professor at Oklahoma State University in their agricultural law department, but he also grew up farming. His family farms, so he has firsthand experience and knowledge of going through these different transitions of handing the farm from one generation to the next, and the legal side of it as well, of getting all those documents in place, because farm and ranches, a lot of times they're a family operation as well as a business. So it's important to plan that transition from one generation to the next. And in the afternoon, they'll also be a lawyer speaking on it as well. And then there will be a panel discussion where you can ask different questions you have and hear from people who have been through this process and gain knowledge from their experience. So the registration deadline is December 1st, and there is a $60 registration fee, but they are offering family scholarships that you can apply for. So you won't actually be registering for this conference with our office, but if you give us a call at 620-331-2690, we can give you the registration information for that, or you can email the new department within the K-State Ag Economics Department. Is the Ag Kansition, so AGKANSITIONS at ksu.edu, and register with them as well.
Sure, and you were just talking about kind of record keeping and a lot of these family businesses, you know, that can be a lot more intense than people realize. I mean,
yes,
I've been
definitely.
I've been in some of these farmhouses where, I mean, it might be the wife has a full-on office set up, you know, with everything you would expect in a big office, just to keep track of, you know, all the goings on, because there is a lot to keep track of.
Yes, there's a lot to keep track of, just for your records and financial records, for taxes and all of those sorts of things.
And animals, and, I mean, all their individual
exactly,
records.
Exactly, all those records, and then different reporting dates to the USDA, those FSA offices. If you have a farm and you do crop insurance, how to work with crop insurance and report different planting dates. There's a lot that goes into it. So there's a lot of considerations when the older generation is getting ready to transition it on to the next generation, and just having all that documentation in place. So when someone does pass away, you know, we never like to think about that, because it's something that's definitely really sad to think about, but it's important to have something, you know, set up there as well.
Even something simple like making sure you share the password to the computer and that
exactly,
sort of thing.
Yeah.
You know, we had a family member pass away and we don't know his phone, you know, PIN.
Uh-huh.
So you can't get into that. So just, you know, things like that is always something to remember. So that sounds like a really good program. Also in the world of animals, speaking of which, we have in the world of sheep and goat gestation. Where are we in kind of the time frame there?
Yeah, so that time frame will vary a little bit for each breeder and when their does and ewes are due to kid. So for myself and for all folks who have goats due in December, we're coming up on late gestation, and a lot of people around here that raise goats for 4-H'ers to show at the fair later on in July, they'll start having those kids and lambs hit the ground in December through February. So goats and sheep, they have a 5-month gestation. So 4 to 6 weeks before their due date is what is considered late gestation. And late gestation and then early lactation, so the first couple weeks after those kids and lambs are born, is when does and ewes have the highest nutritional need. Late gestation is also when 70% of the fetal growth takes place. And because of that, their rumen capacity decreases. Goats and sheep are ruminants, which means they have one stomach and 4 chambers. The rumen is one of those chambers, and it is where the hay and the roughage, the feed that they consume, where they digest it and break it down. So because their rumen capacity decreases, they can't eat as much at one time. So you want to make sure that you're feeding them high quality feed, so it's easier for them to meet those protein and energy requirements while consuming a smaller amount of feed at one time. Usually, energy is the biggest requirement during this time of year, especially as the weather gets colder as too. They'll need more energy or they'll be using more energy to stay warm. So you want to make sure you're feeding them a high energy feed, something that's high in fat and protein, especially when we're dealing with lower quality forage like we have this year, unfortunately, due to the drought. You will probably need to supplement them with crude protein as well. So to meet these increased crude protein and energy requirements, feeding them about a half pound to a pound of grain a day will do a lot to help them out. And this will also depend a little bit on the size of the sheep and goats that you are feeding. So with goats especially, some folks have miniature dairy goats, such as Nigerian dwarfs. So they won't need that half pound to a pound of feed. You can go with about a quarter pound of grain for them. But your full-size dairy goats or your meat goats, then about half a pound to a pound of grain as an added supplement is about right for them. That's the same with sheep as well. And then you also want to keep in mind the weight of that animal will play a role in how much additional supplementation they need in the form of grain and their body condition. So we can body condition score sheep and goats to give you an ideal if they're need additional supplementation. So if they're really skinny, then they'll need more additional supplementation coming into late gestation. And when they have those kids and lambs, then one that is on the heavier side, maybe it's the bully in the herd that pushes everyone else out and, you know, they're fat and sassy and are good to go. So because of that, if you're able to separate your goats and sheep out based on age and size, that makes it a little bit easier to meet the nutritional needs of each animal. Or maybe you have older animals that are a little bit slower to get to that feed trough, and you can put them in a separate pen or pasture to eat. And then if you have hay and you're not sure about the nutritional value of it, you can take a sample of that hay and we can send it off to be tested at the lab. And then that will give you the protein levels in that hay and the energy levels as well. And then using that, we can help you determine what type of grain ration is a good fit to feed with that hay. And if you're interested in taking a hay sample and sending it off, you can contact any one of our extension offices. We have hay probes that you can borrow that will help you get a good representative sample of the hay. And then, of course, check your goats and sheep, especially the does that are close to kidding and lambing, but all of them, to see if they need to be treated for parasites. We've had a dry year, so that has decreased the number of parasites, but because that grass hasn't been growing as much in the pastures, the goats and sheep have been kind of grubbing it off, eating close to the ground. And when they eat close to the ground like that, they're eating right where those parasites will live in the ground. So there's an increased risk that they picked more of them up that way. So if you have one that has a rougher hair coat, or a sheep that is losing some wool and is poor body condition, those are some good indicators that it needs to be dewormed. And of course, for barber pole worms, blood-sucking parasites, you can look at their inner eyelid color as well. And if it is a light pink to white color, that means they do have a barber pole worm problem and they need to be dewormed for those specifically.
Sure. Okay. I got it. And it is, there's so much to keep track of, and it just seems like a terrible time of year. You know, it would be in the middle of winter when they got a kid and lamb, but you know, that's the way it is. Now, as we kind of head into that season, and correct me if I'm wrong, isn't it important to make sure that the lambs stay with their mother? You don't get them mixed up because, you know, otherwise the mother will basically reject them if they're not theirs. Is the same thing true for goats?
Yes. So that's very important, especially when you have a first-time mother. Sometimes they get a little bit confused, especially it's common for sheep and goats to have multiples, so at least twins, sometimes triplets as well. So sometimes that will confuse a new mom. She might know, you know, one for sure is hers, and then she's not really sure about the other one or two. She might have a hard time keeping track of them. So when that happens, if you keep them in a smaller pen, maybe a pen even by themselves, if that's a possibility, for a couple of days, that will help that doe or ewe bond with her kids and lambs. The other thing to watch out for that sometimes happens is if you have an older doe or ewe that is close to kidding or lambing, but she hasn't kitted herself yet. Sometimes, especially when they're a really good mom, which is great, they'll come over and try to lick and clean off those kids that are not theirs. They belong to a newer doe. And especially if that doe is younger, usually she's kind of lower on the pecking order. So she might be kind of timid and back off a little bit because it's an older doe coming over to take care of them. So that's something else to watch out for, because when another doe has licked and cleaned off those kids, they no longer smell like the mom. So she's won't take them or will be more hesitant to take them. And if that does happen, there's some different tricks you can do, like putting Vicks on their nose and then Vicks on the tail and the top of the head of the kid. And then that will help sometimes, because all they can smell is the Vicks, and then everything kind of smells the same to them.
And I would assume maybe, you know, if you have a larger operation, having some pens to kind of separate all this out, because it could get kind of chaotic, I feel like.
Yeah. So that depends a lot on the particular operation. So sometimes, especially with meat goats, they just kid out on the pasture, and then the owner checks on them a couple times a day to make sure everything's going good, there's no problems. That's a lower intensity operation. But with sheep especially, sheep have the reputation of not being the smartest animal. So people will set up smaller pens in the barn, and then once those ewes have lambed, they'll put the ewe and her lamb. Those smaller pens are referred to as lambing jugs. So they'll put them in a jug for a couple of days and then turn them out with a group of five or so other ewes that had their lambs about the same time, and then leave them there for a few more days and then turn them back out on the pasture with a bigger group. Especially like the end of this week, we're coming up on some colder weather.
So low 20s.
A warm place for those kids and lambs to go is very important, especially since we start in December and then, you know, go through March or so. So during those cold weather months,
and then you just get ready for some long nights ahead. to take care of all this is it can be exciting. Well, David, anything else that we should know on this or any other topics?
The only other thing to add, because it is, like you said, it's getting down to the lower 20s this week, and some people do like to put heat lamps for their animals to help them stay warm, is make sure you have those heat lamps securely attached. So, of course, grabbing baling twine is always really handy and easy to grab, but it's really not the best option, because if you get a curious goat, for example, that's able to reach it and nibbles on it, then they can actually chew through it and cause the heat lamp to fall.
Oh, yeah.
So you want to use something a little bit more secure, like wire, chain even, or some heavy duty rope if you have it. And then don't tie the heat lamp off by its cord, but attach that wire or whatever you're using to the heat lamp and tie it off that way and keep it well above the shavings or straw if you're using that as bedding.
Sure. And then, of course, poultry, by this point, people should already have some supplemental lighting if they want laying to continue, right?
Yes. Yes, definitely. Since time change happened, if they want to have good egg production through the winter, adding that supplemental lighting in the form of a heat lamp or just a regular light bulb.
Sure.
We'll help them out.
Yeah, no, I've always had good luck just with the heat lamp on those, and they seem to like it, so yep. Good deal. All right, well, David, always a pleasure. Holly, thank you for everything. You know, it's just I was learned so much when I have you folks in, and look forward to next time.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. And we'll continue. We have some folks from the Church of the Nazarene will have an update here in just moments on the Mighty 690. And then, of course, we have Open Line on the way here on KGGF. So don't go anywhere. You are listening to the Mighty 690 KGGF Coffeeville.